What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Alex Gladstein is the Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation and a guest lecturer at Singularity University. In this conversation, we talked about Bitcoin, foreign aid, Web 3.0 as a decentralized world, unbanking the banked, and the surveillance state. I really enjoyed this intellectually deep conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, welcome. We have Alex here. Thank you so much for coming and making this happen.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure. Can't wait.
I'm super excited. As many of you probably know, Alex is the Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation, and he's a guest lecturer at Singularity University. So that's what you're doing now. Maybe let's just start with your background, and then we can figure out how you eventually ended up playing with Internet Magic Money.
Sure. Yeah, so I think this conversation is going to start a little bit differently than some of your other guests, because I come from the world of political science and studying governance and government, as opposed to studying finance and money. And at the Human Rights Foundation, we study authoritarianism. You know, we study the way that societies are built, and we study the fact that about 52% of the people in today's world live under a highly centralized government, where all the power is in one place, under one person, one king, one lord, one dictator. And that's kind of how human history always was, right?
Yep.
After the agricultural revolution, people shaped themselves into these kind of hierarchical top-down governance structures. But you know what? 2,600 years ago, someone had a really cool idea. Let's be ruled by rules, not rulers. This was Cleisthenes in ancient Greece. And for the last 2,600 years, we've been tinkering with this idea of democracy, literally, you know, rule by the people. So democracy is a technology that disrupts and decentralizes political power in the same way that the internet is a technology that disrupts information power and Bitcoin is a technology that disrupts financial power. So throughout this conversation, I want to kind of keep coming back to this sort of triple theme of government, information, money, and how democracy, the internet, and Bitcoin have changed and are going to change things for the better.
Got it. And so when did you first come across crypto or Bitcoin?
Sure. So at the Human Rights Foundation, we work with people who live under dictatorships, authoritarian regimes, and for them, technology is really important. It's either being used against them to surveil and spy and control them, right? Or it's a liberation tool, right? So people have been using encrypted messaging apps like Signal and Wickr, you know, even like more basic stuff like PGP for years. Digital hygiene is really important for them, right? You know, for us, it's kind of a luxury, slippery slope type thing. But, you know, if you're living in a country like Burma and you're doing investigative work, you're doing anti-corruption work, it's very important that you keep your information safe, right? So we've always worked with tech companies and people who are trying to build tools to help activists. And, you know, again, that includes encrypted messages, VPNs, ways to like fight censorship and surveillance. A couple of years ago, I got into a conversation with a guy named Bill Tai, who's a total legend. Bill has been mining Bitcoin since 2010 in his apartment. He's the one who eventually introduced Richard Branson to Bitcoin. It's why Richard Branson hosts this sort of Bitcoin, you know, brainstorming session on his island in the Caribbean. And Bill was like, hey, I'm on the board of this organization called Bitfury. We should do something together, right? And Bitfury was is at the time and now still a very prominent Bitcoin mining company. And that was in 2016. And then the next year, we brought a Bitcoin conversation to the Oslo Freedom Forum, which is the conference that the Human Rights Foundation, we produce each year in Norway, which brings together activists and journalists and people who are fighting for a free world together. And the activists get to tell their story on stage to a huge room of, you know, influencers and people who can make a difference. It's kind of like the Davos model flipped on its head, where instead of like the bankers and people in control on stage, it's the people who are trying to disrupt the establishment on stage, and the establishment's listening. This is our sort of flipped model. But anyway, we started bringing in Bitcoin into this because, at least, you know, I believe that censorship resistant money is such an important tool for people who are struggling under authoritarian governments, hyperinflation, tight financial controls, financial surveillance.
And let's, before we get really deep into Bitcoin and the kind of decentralized money, let's start with just pure centralized money, right? Mm-hmm. I think most people understand how the fiat world works, but what are the downsides to kind of centralized money?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about cash and we talk about fiat money, we need to understand we're entering into a world that's going to be cashless, right? So one thing is if a government creates money and prints it and allows us to have that, right? So we're walking around exchanging $20 bills, right? That at least still has a semblance of privacy and ownership and sovereignty. Of course, bad things can happen with inflation, things like that. But generally speaking, when I hand you a $20 bill, I mean, that's a bearer asset. That's a private transaction, right? And people, I think, are underestimating how powerful that is. You know, we've always had cash in civilization. A lot of people who attack Bitcoin like to say that, like, oh, all this crime is going to happen with private money. We've always had private money. I'm more concerned about a world without private money. So the writing is on the wall for all societies in 10, 20, 30 years to be living in a completely digital financial world. We're not going to be carrying around pieces of paper and metal anymore. These are going to be looked back at as like fossils, basically, right? From a different age. And in that world, I want to make sure we have privacy, freedom, and rights over our money. Because if not, it's going to be mass financial surveillance and then social engineering. And we're seeing this played out in real time in China today. And it's terrifying. And I don't think people want that.
Yeah, explain a little bit more about what's going on in China for those that don't know.
Sure. So, you know, I'm not sure where exactly all the listeners here are. Chances are you live in a relatively free society where there's a separation of technology and state, which is like a kind of an important idea, meaning the U.S. government, for example, or the German government or the Norwegian government, you know, countries like that, they don't control the tech companies. They can like get into arguments and try to tell them what to do. But generally speaking, there's a separation, right? In China, the Chinese Communist Party basically owns, you know, these technology companies. There may be like a formal separation, but they have to do whatever the Communist Party says. So they become tools, right? So the Communist Party has used the tech companies to create technology infrastructure that can suck all of the personal, financial, health, location, communications, behavior data up of its citizens through tools like WeChat, which is a super app that basically is so much better than anything we might have here in the United States that does absolutely everything, ranging from, you know, think about Uber, Amazon, Twitter, Google Maps, all in the same thing, right? And it's what most urban Chinese people use every day to connect to everything, right? So the terrifying side of it is that the government has all this data, right? So step one for these authoritarian governments in the information age is to build this data collection mechanism. Step two is social engineering. So once they have all the data, then they start thinking about the carrots and sticks they can put out there to make you stay loyal, right? Because violence alone is not very efficient in controlling a population. What's much better if people have to police themselves, right? So if people in China today are now starting to think about, oh, I shouldn't say that because then I won't be able to get fast internet or get a visa to leave the country or get a good rate on my mortgage or send my kids to a good school, that's a really powerful incentive, right? So what the Chinese government is starting to build, it's experimenting all across the country. There's not like one unified system, but is this idea of a social credit system system, and they want to implement it nationally in the next few years. They've been very open about this. And the idea is that unlike a credit score here, where it's just sort of like your financial behavior and are you paying back your credit card on time and, you know, how responsible have you been? They add in your friend circle and your behaviors and your sexuality and your ethnicity and your religion and things like that. And that adds to basically what amounts to a social credit score, which basically is like a loyalty score. So the government is going to use that to determine whether you get access to like basic goods and services. So not only are they sucking up all this information with no limits on your, you know, there's no such thing as like individual privacy, but then they can use that to start shaping the population. And that's something that's going to happen everywhere, including in your country, wherever you are right now listening to this, unless you stop it. And there's two ways to stop it: old school human rights and civil liberties advocacy, and building technology that can't be manipulated by authoritarian governments.
And I think you are in the same camp as I am of like, there's an inevitability of us living in cashless society, right? That around the corner is a Joe and the Juice and they don't take cash, right? They literally said, I heard themselves tell somebody you have to not use cash here. And so if that's going to happen, I think the argument you're making is either we can try to plea with governments or any sort of authoritarian regime to not surveil, not do nefarious things, or you just build the technology from day one in a way that cannot be manipulated, cannot be abused, etc.
Yeah, there's a great quote from a famous cryptographer named Wei Dai, and he says something like, you know, governments are always going to take freedom from their people. It's inevitable. Even the most benevolent ones will find a way, right? Mm-hmm. So let's make technology that makes that impossible, you know? And that was the ethos that went into the creation of Bitcoin. Let's make something that they can't control. Let's make something that empowers individuals.
So let's talk about cashless society, right? And I think that we're aligned in building that technology that's not manipulated. But what does that look like from a user experience standpoint? Right. If I'm a citizen living in a cashless society, how does my life look different than today?
I mean, it's a creeping difference, right? Mm-hmm. It's something you don't wake up
tomorrow and it happens.
You're not like, oh, my God, my life's so much different than it was. But when you think about it, think about your life now versus 10 years ago for most of your listeners. I mean, a lot of things are touchless. You start to use your phone for a lot of things, paying back friends, things like that. It all sort of happens off your phone as like the central point of, you know, your financial life. As opposed to 10, 15 years ago, obviously that wasn't the case. So there has been a dramatic change. It's just been very creeping and slow, right? Mm-hmm. Like I remember the first day someone said, oh, I'll Venmo you. And I was like, what the heck is that, right? Now it's like just, you know, I use it without even thinking.
It's a method of choice.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So it's about convenience, right? And convenience is going to be the key factor here because convenience will win. If you look at the number of people who use like privacy technology, it's fairly small from a percentage basis, right? People who use things like PGP, Signal, things like that. And that's because people in the end, to be frank, don't really care about their privacy, which is highly unfortunate. So what needs to happen is that the people who do care about privacy and who know that it will become so important to the future of money and the way we network with each other, they need to build that into our systems today and make the most convenient and best financial products have privacy. This is a super important idea.
And I think part of the lack of concern about privacy, half of it seems to be people just don't understand why it's important. They don't care about it, etc. The other half is most of the products that they should use from a privacy standpoint are more friction. It's not, you know, kind of built into the daily consumer products that they use. And so it's almost like, oh, that would be harder for me to use, and therefore I'll choose convenience over privacy.
It's been demonized. I mean, a friend of mine pointed this out the other day, but think about the little icon Google uses for incognito. It's like some sketchy dude, right? No, this is like a fundamental human right. I mean, think about it. Do you want everybody else to be able to see what you're doing at all times? No. And again, it's something we're not going to realize until it's too late. Right now, you're probably like, well, I use, you know, Venmo and PayPal, and I don't really own my own money. I mean, it's living with some bank and that's not really causing a problem for me. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not maybe causing a problem for you because you live in a democracy where, you know, the government can't just come take your stuff. But again, 52% of the population of this planet, you know, 4 billion people live under an authoritarian government where they absolutely can, will, and do come and take your stuff. Mm-hmm. So if not for you, for them.
And it feels to me like the creation of Bitcoin and kind of this censorship resistant, you know, seizure resistant money was born out of a time that forced people to understand more about the global financial system than they probably did previously. Do you buy into that narrative, or do you think it's more coincidental that the time and place of where Bitcoin was created just coincided with some of that?
I think it's all about personal responsibility and education. I agree with you. I mean, think about the way that democracy over time has forced people to be more civically engaged and educated about how politics works, right? Think about the way the internet, especially now with all of the you know, competing news sources, let's say, has forced people to think hard about what's real and what's not. Whereas before, they were just listening to whatever the government or, you know, the rich people who ran the newspapers said. There were no other options. Today, when you learn about Bitcoin, you learn about money and you learn about how to control it and how it works. So I think this is all like an arc of personal responsibility and people having to take a little more control in their lives. And I agree that can be a little scary, but I think it's really important for the future so that we don't all become sheep.
Well, it also falls in line with the idea of like decentralized politics or decentralized information, right? Kind of Bitcoin is, as decentralized money, is another component of other aspects of life that have already gone this way, right? So like democracy, I think, you know, you and I have talked about democracy is just merely decentralized politics to mm-hmm. some degree, right?
Absolutely.
And the internet is decentralized information to some degree. Yeah. Bitcoin is an extension or an evolution where we went politics, information, money.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, think about it. In a decentralized society, the people who print the money and the, who make the news and who run the military and who run the justice system and who make the laws and who are in control of science and medicine, they're all different. There's a mm-hmm. separation of powers. And this is kind of the most important thing in a democratic society. That at least allows things like free expression, a marketplace of ideas. It allows things like opposition political parties and opposition politics, civil society, watchdogs, nonprofits, human rights groups, all these things grow out of this idea of separation of powers, of decentralization. At the very top, the cherry on top are elections. Mm-hmm. Elections are just a mechanism. Every dictator has elections. So elections are like the cherry on top of a democratic society. And you can think of this sort of in the same way with information and with money, in as much as the most important thing at the bottom is a separation of powers. So on the internet, we need to have different people who own the production of information, news, and data, and we have to be able to choose. And these entities compete with each other, and it's a marketplace, right? In Bitcoin, the production of money has been decentralized, mm-hmm. right? It's no longer one person. There's no longer a single point of failure. It is kind of like this community effort, which is broken down into miners and merchants, buyers and sellers and coders and people developing infrastructure and users who run full nodes. Mm-hmm. So there's this like really interesting ecosystem of people who all balance each other out. And just like it's really hard to commit a coup in like a healthy democracy, just like it's really hard to pull the wool over someone's eyes if you have a lot of information that you're digesting from the internet, it's really hard to do a coup in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Really difficult. So the interesting thing about decentralized systems is that they're anti-fragile. They're much more strong than centralized societies. Dictatorships can crumble in a moment, right? Mm-hmm. As we've seen many times through history. A healthy democracy cannot crumble in one day. It doesn't work like that. And I think you're going to see the same thing with like the internet and information, of course. And of course, with Bitcoin, these things don't crumble in a day. They're actually stronger. And there's another area that I'd like to dig into a little bit, which is this idea that, you know, oh, Bitcoin is going to allow all these evil people to do things like crime and, you know, terror and drug trafficking. I think this is wrong. Okay. And let's go back to the idea of decentralized politics and government. If you ask a 7-year-old, which society would you rather live in? What's safer, the one with the most police and the most rules and guns, or the one with like a lot less rules and guns where people can kind of do whatever they want? I think they're going to choose the ones, the society with the most rules and guns. But it's counterintuitive. Terrorism and corruption breed inside tyrannies and dictatorships much more than open and free societies. Open and free societies are better for humans, whether you care about patent rates, innovation, advances in science and technology and exploration, whether you care about inequality, fighting poverty, access to water, having everybody have a proper home to live in, whether you care about maternal health rates, literacy, anything under the sun really that's good for humans is better in open societies than in dictatorships. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, but I would also argue that an open information system and an open financial system is going to be better for humans. It's going to have a heck of a lot less corruption and arbitrary abuse of power than our current centralized financial system. I mean, think about how much fraud is done in our current financial system that people, I mean, literally are ignorant to or are ignoring. I mean, we talk about the banks, right? I mean, look at Danske Bank, this one Danish bank. I mean, the $30 billion fraud case that they were caught with a few months ago. I mean, that's more than a third of the entire cryptocurrency market cap. And that's just a drop in the bucket, man.
Well, the United Nations, I think it's the Office of Drugs and Crime, came out this a couple weeks ago now, and they estimate that $2 trillion a year are laundered in the legacy system, which is like 23x what the cryptocurrency entire market cap is. And then on top of that, you look at something like Wells Fargo, right? So Wells Fargo goes down for multiple hours in a day. And it got me thinking about this idea that customers are going to start to demand that the infrastructure and the security is decentralized in the companies that they use. And it would be interesting if it goes from just a, oh, that is nice that it is more secure, or, oh, it is nice to have that it is decentralized, to it becomes irresponsible for an organization or a company to have centralized control of sensitive information or money, et cetera. And that's not going to happen overnight, but that wouldn't surprise me if, 10, 15 years from now, we're actually saying it is irresponsible to not have encryption, right? Just like that happened today. At one point in life, 20, 25 years ago, that wasn't the case. Is decentralization the same thing?
Yeah. I think what gives me great hope and what should give you all great hope is that a decentralized financial system, I think, is going to be just better from every angle than a centralized one, not just for security and privacy, but also for speed, efficiency, all these things. And it doesn't look like that right now. People are going to laugh. Ah, Bitcoin only does a couple transactions per second. Well, you know what? Bitcoin's about 10 years old. Okay, let's see where it is when it's 20 years old. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, decentralized systems can scale exponentially. Centralized financial systems scale linearly, sort of at best, right? So if Visa wants to do like more transactions per second, they have to build more data centers and hire more security guards and interns and HR people and consultants and write a whole bunch of more paperwork and suck down a lot more energy, right? That's a lot, right? When we talk about the way that Bitcoin is like clearly and obviously scaling on these second layer networks like Lightning, these are built in a different way. They're user powered. Anyone can just join. They're permissionless. And they're going to grow organically around the world, just like the internet spread. I have this firm belief that this is sort of the way it's going to play out. And it'll allow us to on-ramp hundreds of millions of people onto Bitcoin in a much faster and more efficient way than it took to on-ramp all these people onto these sort of what we now think of hopefully sort of older financial systems, centralized financial systems like Visa.
How does all this relate to the parallel economies thesis?
Yeah, so there was a Czech thinker, Václav Banda, who in the Soviet-occupied Czechoslovakia was, along with Václav Havel, one of the great thinkers in that country's history, and who fought very bravely for freedom, human rights, free expression. And they noticed while they were under this sort of communist government that they started to interact with each other in an interesting way. They started to create what they called a parallel polis, like a parallel state. And they would kind of live their life humdrum, like up above ground, right? Mm-hmm. Abiding by all the rules, but like by themselves at night in their homes and conversations, they would have like this parallel state, right? They would have this parallel economy. They would have this parallel set of ideas, right? And eventually this ended up winning. And now Czechoslovakia turns into the Czech Republic and is now a free and open democracy. And the kind of conspiring parallel polis people ended up becoming the leaders of this country. And I think it's kind of a metaphor for what's going to happen with Bitcoin in many ways. Bitcoin is a parallel economy. When you think about something like foreign aid and the way that like large money flows around the world, when the US government wants to help people in Rwanda, let's say, I'll pick a country kind of out of the hat, what they have to do is send a whole bunch of money through the banking system of the dictator of that country, in this case, Paul Kagame. And then, you know, Paul Kagame's banking system gets to decide where that money goes. Oh, maybe to that person, but maybe not to that person. They get to take a cut here, cut there. They get to exert financial surveillance, all these things. So that foreign aid goes, and then it sort of trickles down, right, through the system. Does it really reach the individual farmers in the end? Sometimes, but it's very hard to say how, because it's not an opaque system. And certainly it's not all the money. Yep. I mean, it's basically like pouring, foreign aid in many ways is like pouring water into a bucket with holes in it, right? So we can just say, screw that. And we can just go straight peer-to-peer to these people. All they need is a cheap cell phone and an internet connection. Mm-hmm. They can have an open source Bitcoin wallet and we can send them money directly in a censorship resistant peer-to-peer way. I think this is really game changing, and it's going to start to have the most impact in places where the financial system is like broken, is kind of my thesis. So we're already witnessing this in places like China, for example, where I would argue the system is broken because there's these unjust capital controls, right? Or in Venezuela, where there's hyperinflation, or in a place like Iran, where there's sanctions and the people can't interact with their families abroad. So you're starting to see people use Bitcoin in these places where the financial system is sort of broken, because innovation happens at the edge, but it's eventually going to spread.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like the foreign aid issue has a solution today with technology and Bitcoin and kind of the infrastructure that we have? Or is this theoretically there should be a world where this works, and so we've got some work to do to build the infrastructure?
I mean, I think it...
Because it's fascinating to me, this idea of we can now circumvent all of the, I'll just call them the bloodsuckers in the system, right? Everyone who's there who leeches off of the foreign aid, and now they don't have a chance.
No, and they deserve every bit of your ire. I think we need like a kind of like a space race sized, Manhattan Project sized effort, public-private partnership to get this done. There's so much to be gained here. And I'll walk you through how this would start, to be really specific. So I have a friend who's from Burma. She's a member of the Muslim minority, the Rohingya, okay? So she's been persecuted her entire life by this Burmese military dictatorship. Her father was in prison. She was in prison for 7 years. The woman's not even 30 yet. She spent 7 years in prison for being, for having, you know, basically, number one, a different religion from the government, but also different views. And she was telling me about the status of these camps where the Burmese government and their proxies have like basically chased tens and tens of thousands of Rohingya out of Burma into neighboring Bangladesh, like over this river and into these camps now that the Bangladeshi government has, you know, has been basically forced to set up because they don't want them coming into the society, right? So they're in these camps, and we're talking about what is it like in these camps? Do people have passports and IDs? Not really, no. Okay, well, is there internet? Yeah, there's scattered intermittent internet access, okay. Is there markets? Like, are there merchants? Yeah. So every day, like, Bangladeshis come in, buy and sell things, clothing, food, whatever. Okay, so I'm having this conversation with her in Berkeley, California, and I'm telling her, well, we can just send a Bitcoin transaction from our dinner table right here to one of these stateless refugees, and they can receive it. And they don't have to ask permission from any government or bank. They don't have to prove their identity to anybody. This is a peer-to-peer transaction. Now, what do they do with that Bitcoin is a great question. And here's where like on-ramps, off-ramps become really important, local exchanges. And this is where I hope to see a lot of like effort being expended by do-gooders in the future. But think about it. Eventually, someone's going to figure out they can make a pretty good living being a broker who comes into that camp and accepts Bitcoin in exchange for different goods and services, right? So here we've just completely disintermediated the entire banking and aid system and just turned this into a peer-to-peer operation. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
Absolutely. And going back to this idea of like the identity and if the financial system works, right, mm-hmm. in terms of a decentralized financial system that allows you sitting in Berkeley, California to send money directly to a refugee or somebody who needs aid, that identification is sometimes an oxymoron, I think, in crypto. You hear a lot about using blockchain and other kind of decentralized technologies to create digital identity on a blockchain, verifiable, you know, all mm-hmm. of this stuff that sounds great theoretically. But then we talk about a permissionless financial system where maybe actually identity is a negative piece to the financial system. How do you balance those two ideas around the actual application in, you know, foreign aid or maybe some of the other ways that you think adoption happens here?
Well, look, in the same way that the internet disintermediated a lot of the control over information and news, and now, you know, anyone can kind of have their voice, and you know that we're struggling with that. That's an evolution, but it's gonna, you're gonna sort of see the same effect with Bitcoin, in as much as we're not gonna need state provided financial identities anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna have to go and beg some bureaucrat for the ability to receive money from my family. This is gonna be a big change, and people are gonna fight it because people have a lot to lose, right? The financial industry is massive. And what we're going to basically see is that the very concept of what is identity. I mean, generally speaking, identity is something that a nation state confers upon someone so that they can participate in that nation state. What we're probably going to see is less of the like, let's bank all the unbanked and let's unbank the banked.
Explain what that means.
Yeah. So people say, let's bank the unbanked. Like, let's bring all these people who don't have access to the financial system into the financial system. I think what we need to be thinking about is bringing some of the people who are part of that financial system kind of out of it so they can have more control over their own money and so that they have more of their own money and have more say in where it goes.
It's timely we're talking about this because the South Korean Central Bank just did this big 6-8 month study mm-hmm. on central bank digital currencies, right? So kind of state-backed issued digital uh-huh. currencies. And what they looked at was if they created a kind of Bank of Korea issued digital currency,
yeah.
what the impact would be on the legacy system. And what they literally say in the paper is people will choose to trust the blockchain based digital currency uh-huh. over the fiat currency held in a commercial bank. And we cannot allow that to happen because the second people trust the blockchain based one, they will begin to withdraw capital from the commercial banks, and the deposits are how they do lending, and so they'll have to raise rates, and they'll have this whole kind of ripple effect on the legacy system. And so rather than saying blockchain-based digital currencies are better, mm-hmm. they just say we're not going to issue one because we actually think it'll have a negative effect on these organizations that people don't trust, right, on the banks. And so in my mind, people aren't going to not use blockchain-based digital currencies, they're just going to go find a non-sovereign one, right? They're going to go find a Bitcoin and say, I'm going to withdraw the money anyways. I might not do it as rapidly or kind of violently, but I'm going to still take my money out of your system and opt into this other system.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we start getting into the world of whether it's dictator coins or nation state coins or Fed coin or Facebook coin, I think there's kind of limited returns here. I mean, how different are these things really than the existing digital money we have? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, is it centralized or is it not? Does mm-hmm. it have a back door or does it not? Bitcoin doesn't have a back door. There's no one who can sit there and edit the records on the back end. The reason why the Chinese government is really into blockchain, this idea of this word blockchain, is because it can kind of connote this idea of transparency and accountability to the people. You know, they can market that. Xi Jinping has given these huge speeches about how blockchain is going to change China. And the Communist Party ran this program about 8 months ago saying that blockchain was going to be like 10 times bigger than the internet. And Jack Ma keeps saying it's not about Bitcoin, it's about blockchain. This is because they can kind of fool the people. They can kind of say, hey, we're going to crack down on corruption and make things more transparent with this open ledger. But in reality, they're absolutely going to have the keys to that ledger. And that's going to be a ledger that they edit on the back end. So it's not really revolution at all. So it's total like wolf in sheep's clothing, right? And that's what you see with a lot of these sort of blockchain projects. The real question you should be asking yourself is not whether it's a blockchain or not, but is there a backdoor or not? And if there's no backdoor, then that becomes really interesting. That's why Bitcoin's such a revolution. Then it kind of takes the cheat code out from the government. They can no longer edit the records and print whatever money they want. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of governments, when you look at the money supply, a lot of it's digital anyway to begin with. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about these, like, you know, nation state, you know, central bank cryptocurrencies, things like that, I mean, are we going to see more of these? Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Petro was sort of the first one in Venezuela, and that's not working out so well. It's a tool of repression, not of liberation, obviously. But the Saudis and the Iranians, the Chinese, you know, they're all building some sort of nation state currency. And you know what? You know, people, savvy people are going to be like, well, you know, maybe that's a good investment. And maybe it's smart for nation states to start doing this. But it's a different technology completely from Bitcoin. I mean, that doesn't create a parallel economy. That let's say centralized cryptocurrencies that nation states and companies run only increase their power over you. Okay. Bitcoin is operating on a different level. Bitcoin is taking their power away and is giving it back to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think part of this is the Central Bank of South Korea realized if people get access to this type of technology, they will essentially circumvent all of the legacy organizations, infrastructure, etc., which they don't want.
Yeah, and I think this is not a process that happens immediately. I'm someone who doesn't believe that. You know, I don't think governments and banks are going anywhere. I just think they're going to be forced to change, just like they were forced to change with the idea of democracy, just like they were forced to change when the internet came and started to empower people and allowed a lot more knowledge and information and investigation and journalism. You know, we live in an age where people know a lot more than they did several hundred years ago. And we live in an age in a lot of the world where people have control over their governments and can kick them out if they're being corrupt or repressive, which is an astonishing change in the world. I mean, to go from a world where all we had were dictators of different shapes and sizes and flavors and whatever, to a world where nearly half the world is ruled by people themselves is extraordinary. And I think it should give us great hope that eventually, although the road is rocky, the internet and the ability for anyone to hold the whole sum of human knowledge in their pocket is eventually going to do the same thing for news. And Bitcoin holds the same promise for money. Mm-hmm. And I think this is just so powerful, this idea that you can kind of own and control your own money and have a participation in that ecosystem. I mean, when you think about just the very idea of when someone sends a Bitcoin transaction to you, I was helping my father-in-law set up his ledger, right? And we're doing this and we're putting the money on the ledger, right? And then we put the money on the ledger. And it's kind of this moment where it's like, okay, that's mine now. No one can take it from me, you know, whatever. It could get burned or buried. As long as you have the backup codes, it's fine. You can have a brain wallet. I mean, you can walk across a border with $1 billion in your head, right? This is
wild.
This
is, that is absolutely wild. Wild.
Yeah, I mean, it is wild. So, and we're just at the beginning. I mean, the crazy thing for me and what I want to focus on at the Human Rights Foundation with our efforts in this area is education. This is first and foremost so critical. Most people to begin with in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space couldn't even pass a basic 10-word questionnaire about how Bitcoin works. Let's change that. Everybody should read this book called Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos, no matter what you're doing. If you're an investor, a trader, a builder, whether you're building an enterprise project or you're building something on a decentralized computing platform like Ethereum, you should read this book because at least you'll understand how, like, the very idea of why we needed a blockchain in the first place was to create this decentralized money system of Bitcoin. And you'll learn a lot about how it works. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be a coder or a technical person to understand this book. I think it's really important that we start with education first. And then from there, we can start talking to people in real terms that aren't overly complicated about how this is sort of going to start to change their life, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's, in many ways, we can learn a lot from, you know, how email and the internet and e-commerce came about, you know, in the early 90s and mid 90s, you know, most people were kind of afraid of it, right? And like, they didn't think it was going to change the world. Well, we've kind of seen this movie before, right? Mm-hmm. And I was talking with someone who's in the telecommunications industry in India, and he was saying in 1994, like, you know, most people didn't think everybody would have a cell phone, but he knew he could just feel it. He could just see that this was what was going to happen. And there were so many people at that time and those years prior who knew the internet was going to change everything. But most people were kind of like, you know, nah. I mean, you know, there's so much inertia and criticism of any major innovation. I mean, look at the cell phone, look at the telephone. Apparently no one wanted to buy it at the time when Graham Bell came up with it, right? They were like, that's never going to work. Look at the car. Everybody was like, well, we have horse and carriages, and how are cars going to work on the horse roads? Look at the airplane. You know, look at the internet, right? So Bitcoin's the same way. People are going to be skeptical of it, attack it until they understand it. So again, education is the key piece here. And I think we need to do a lot more to create educational materials which are clear about what is Bitcoin, why was it created, and how can you get involved with it. Now, separately, then you would break that out and separate that from other crypto and blockchain projects, mm-hmm. which have different goals. Okay, some of them are very laudable. For example, Zcash and Monero. At the moment, Bitcoin is not a privacy technology. Is it better than using the existing banking system where the government can just call up the bank and get all your records? Of course it is. It takes enormous amounts of energy and money to hire Chain Analysis or one of these companies and play this like investigative game to find you. But they can.
But they can do it.
They can do it in the end. So it's better than the existing system, but it's not what we need when it comes to private money. So that's why efforts like Monero and Zcash are so important. Not only are they innovating in this space, they are creating communities of people who care about private money and are building stuff that may one day get sucked into Bitcoin. Now, there are other projects, whether they are decentralized computing platforms like Ethereum or, you know, enterprise supply chain stuff. You know, those things need to be separated out and treated as completely different technology subjects than Bitcoin. They shouldn't get to like latch on to Bitcoin. You know, oftentimes I live in San Francisco and I hear these famous VCs and all these people talk about crypto and blockchain. They're describing an imaginary idea. You know, I'll hear someone talk for 90 minutes about crypto's gonna do this, that, and the other thing. What do they really mean? What they really mean is Bitcoin plus like a bunch of other magical things that they think are cool. Same thing with blockchain. You'll even get a really well-known book written by famous people where they're talking about how blockchain's gonna do this, that, and the other. They really mean is Bitcoin. So I think it's really important in the education piece to teach people about Bitcoin, why it works, and why it's different than other things. Like the goals of the Bitcoin community are to create a decentralized money system that's extremely different from like, creating a decentralized computing platform or, you know, helping supply chains become more efficient. I think this is a very, very key thing that we need to do.
And I would argue that if the Bitcoin community is successful in building decentralized money, they will be successful in building decentralized computing and all these other things. We just saw Abra recently announced that they're going to do, you know, essentially tokenized stocks. So you can buy Apple, quote unquote, right? But it's all on the Bitcoin network. And so I think that people will build not just for the asset of Bitcoin, but they will build other things on top of what today is the most secure computing network in the world.
I mean, I'm so excited about what people are going to build on top of Bitcoin. I mean, not only are they going to find ways to attach, like what you're saying, you know, different kinds of assets and different ways to create value and exchange value, but I mean, we're going to create entirely new payment networks. I mean, think about, I love thinking about the idea of, you know, micropayments. I mean, you had this talk at the TED conference in Vancouver last year where Jaron Lanier, who's the guy who came up with the term virtual reality back in the 80s, I mean, total legend. And he's talking about how when we created the internet, we sort of had this fatal sin, right? Because we wanted this sort of like lefty idea of like the internet should be free for everybody, right? But those same people loved Steve Jobs and loved the entrepreneurs, right? So what was the sacrifice that was made? What was the compromise that was made? Advertising, right? So Jean Lanier talks about how this has corrupted the original vision of this peer-to-peer web 1.0, right? And now we live in an age where all of our data is owned by giant companies. You look down at your phone, you don't own any of that. You don't own your Uber locations. You don't own your Google Maps locations. You don't own your Netflix stuff. You don't own your Amazon purchases. I mean, someone else has that data on some cloud computing data center somewhere else. And that's kind of where we are today. And he ended his talk with like a clarion call for like, we should be able to communicate and transact with each other without third parties interfering, without third parties spying and profiting. And this is kind of the key message of Bitcoin. Because what's interesting is I see a lot of people agree on this in the same way that's like pretty universally agreed by people who at least can access information that democracy is better than dictatorship. Like people should have a right to participate in their government. That's like a universal right, right? We're starting to see the same sort of universal agreement around maybe it's really bad that like Amazon and Facebook and Google and all these people control all of our data information. Let's figure out a way to disintermediate that. But where we're missing is in the solutions department. And if you start thinking about what you can build on Bitcoin, the censorship resistant network that nobody owns, the possibilities are pretty intriguing. So if you think about what could end up happening with something like a Lightning Network, where you can do these tiny little instantaneous censorship resistant micropayments, right? If we invest enough love and care and resources into this and it grows the right way, I mean, you know, is advertising even necessary anymore? I think the business models will change. I mean, people can do, whether it's you call it a la carte or whatever, people are going to be able to buy, articles by the word or listen to music by the second or whatever, drive their car and pay their taxes by the foot. It's a little bit of a dream, and I know it's not going to quite shape out like that, but you sort of get what I'm saying, right? I mean, if we can have micropayments, then it sort of provides us an attack vector on the surveillance state and on this sort of like, web 2.0, advertising behemoth. Yeah, it gives us a way of getting in there and shaking that up.
What you're describing here from a practical standpoint would be somebody who's got a Netflix account, rather mm-hmm. than pay their 10, 12, 13 bucks, whatever it is now per month, instead they're going to pay as they go, right? They're going to say, all right, I'm going to pay up to 15 bucks a month. And if I don't watch anything this month, I pay zero. If I watch, 75 minutes, I pay, 75 cents or whatever it is. And kind of as they consume, they pay over time.
It's more like about cutting out Netflix completely and paying the content creators directly, mm-hmm. right? Because there isn't really a good infrastructure for that. And I think it's also more about paying content creators directly with like blogs, newspapers, like the emerging new way information mm-hmm. is consumed. I mean, think about the way Twitter has changed everything, right? I mean, and now you're seeing Medium, right? And you're seeing these things where you can just reach out and podcasts like yours. I mean, you guys, content creators, should be able to have a really healthy relationship with your consumers, right? Your clients, basically. And right now that's all being done through intermediaries. Mm-hmm. But I think, in the end, I think Bitcoin and things that are being built on top of Bitcoin will change this de facto reality that there has to be this intermediary. Who right now, let's face it, provide a very valuable service. I mean, there's a reason why, content creators pay someone else to help them. Mm-hmm. But I think that is going to be less necessary in the future. And in the end of the day, intermediaries don't add value. Okay. So, I mean, they provide something. It's kind of like a stepping stool or like training wheels. Eventually, we're not going to need them anymore.
What you're describing is Web 3.0 is not just about decentralized money. It's also about decentralized information, decentralized data, decentralized infrastructure. Right? Mm-hmm. Is there kind of a sequential way that this has to happen where we have to get the decentralized money first and mm-hmm. then we get decentralized data, et cetera? Or can it happen simultaneously?
So I like to think of this as like a family of technologies that are related. And Bitcoin is kind of first step, decentralized money. But then you also have other non-blockchain related technologies that are going to be extremely important in this area. So, for example, censorship resistant storage. If we're going to have decentralized money, we should also have the ability to put things on the internet and store them and share them with the world in a way that no one can take down. So obviously BitTorrent was like an early pioneer in this area. And it's just amazing. We've already seen that humans want this. I mean, this thing, what? It consumed like half the internet traffic for like years. And it was impossible to kill. I mean, the only way to kill something like BitTorrent and Bitcoin is if it becomes useless and then people stop using it. No central party or individual can come in and just kill it, you know? It's an idea. And we're going to see other things beyond censorship-resistant money and censorship-resistant storage. We're going to see, I mean, when it comes to more advanced encryption of your data and like stuff like zero knowledge proofs and me being able to prove to you something without showing you, this is such an exciting area. I mean, we're talking about the possible reality of, you know, me having my location data, health data, whatever data, sovereign to me, stored locally on me, and then I get to disclose what I want to third parties. So I get to disclose what I want to the healthcare industry or to Google, who's tracking me or whatever. I can selectively do that, and maybe I decide to start selling some of that data. Mm-hmm. But again, I think these kind of like what I call anti-authoritarian technologies, advanced forms of encryption like zero-knowledge cryptography, censorship-resistant money, censorship-resistant storage, decentralized internet access, so that we aren't just relying on one internet service provider, that we have satellite internet and we have different ways of getting online and mesh networks. I mean, again, all of these things contribute to the same decentralized future that we need to go to, or else we're going to end up with the WeChatization of all of our lives.
Mm-hmm. As we go down this path, right, you talked a little bit earlier about personal responsibility. How much can we rely on people's kind of self-motivation, right, versus is it the responsibility of developers and technologists to build technologies that are convenient, that can grab the attention of users, and it's their responsibility to make sure that they're putting these people into an environment where there is privacy, security, lack of control and essential authority, et cetera?
Well, just stop and think about the way that technology has changed in the last 10, 20 years. I mean, you've seen society go from learning about email to learning about e-commerce to people starting to own laptops and phones, and these things kind of shrink and become more convenient and become more powerful. I mean, it seems quite inevitable that we're starting to get into the sort of like AR wearable space, right? Of course, like things like the Apple Watch are becoming kind of like ubiquitous. This is just going to proceed. And it seems obvious to me that eventually we're all going to have chips of some kind. We're going to have, you know, bio enhancements. This seems kind of quite clear to me. And you look
I joke all the time. We already have the chips. They're just not under our skin yet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's not that far of a stretch. So, I mean, you think about this progress of technology, and you just start to realize how important it is that we don't become kind of like control points for some government or for some corporation. It's so essential that we build privacy and freedom into this technology now and not later. And that's why there's like, even on a micro level, debates in Bitcoin about, oh, should we scale or should we do privacy? Well, I think we should do privacy first, right? I think that's the most important thing. And it should be for any of these projects that you all you people listening are working on. You know, in the end of the day, what I'm saying is that we're all going to be reliant on technology. We already all are, and we're going to be increasing reliant on it as even just enters us. I mean, you read stuff like Yuval Noah Harari, right? And you think about the way that, you know, we're all going to start kind of merging with technology, right? And that's why this is so critical to do now. And that's why like technologists are going to control the future. So the people building things like networks and communications protocols and financial protocols and things like Bitcoin, I mean, they are dictating our future. They are building the rails for which, you know, we are going to move forward on. So they have enormous responsibility. And you, whoever you're listening, whether you're an investor, a builder, a student, I mean, I think you need to get involved now. I think you need to learn about Bitcoin and how it works. I think you need to take some of those lessons into what you're building and help us build a future where we can protect our rights and freedoms. I mean, or else we're going to end up as, you know, pawns in someone else's game.
For sure. Before I wrap up, I like to do rapid fire, but I don't want to go quickly. I'm actually super interested in some of your thoughts here. What do you think is the most important company in crypto?
The most important company in crypto? That's a great question.
That's where I normally say I only ask great questions.
I'll kind of take it slow and talk about a couple different things.
You're the only person that's allowed to answer with more than one answer.
All right. I'll have an answer.
Okay.
But I'll kind of give like some second place people, okay? Or like some other people that are really important. Look, at the end of the day, building Bitcoin infrastructure to me is the most important thing about crypto at the moment. So we talk about wallets. We talk about ways for people to own their own Bitcoin, on-ramps, off-ramps. What's maybe a little counterintuitive. I think everything like people promoting the ownership of full nodes like Casa, really important. People building infrastructure like Lightning, Lightning Labs, for example, Blockstream, really important. Companies that are building private money like Zcash, I think actually really important. The little guys who are building stuff like this awesome Wasabi wallet that can do end-to-end encrypted Bitcoin transactions, really important. But right now, what's kind of ironic and intuitive and may kind of maybe trigger some people, but I think what's really key is on-ramping people into Bitcoin. So that's why I think like right now, companies like Square and Coinbase are the most important, because that's how people are acquiring Bitcoin and starting to get involved. You don't start from an area of expertise. Mm-hmm. No one starts by being a Bitcoin expert. They start by acquiring a little bit, hearing about it, learning about how it works. So on-ramps right now to me are absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. So, I think the way Square has done it is so amazing. And I would say that they're probably number one in my book.
Yeah. I usually answer Bitcoin, and I think that my second answer would be anything that's the infrastructure to in and around Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So I think that's fair. What's your most controversial thought? Meaning, what do you believe that you think most other people would disagree with?
Okay, so I got the tremendous opportunity to be a guest of someone at the World Economic Forum this year.
Oh,
my
awesome.
First time I went, and I've never been before. It's so fascinating. It's like all the world leaders, everybody who controls everything on the planet in one place. You know, morals off the table. Dictators, thieves, criminals, legitimate heads of state, bankers, everybody in one place, right? It's so fascinating. And it's like a real rogues gallery mixed with all the good guys too. You know, it's really, really interesting.
Good guys, thieves, who are pretending to be good guys.
It's just a place where people put morals off the table and just say, let's party, you know? Yep. Let's have the Saudis sit down next to Tim Cook, you know? Someone who might be responsible for our future privacy and building the equipment that we're going to use hopefully in the future, sitting down next to somebody, you know, who's representing a government that assassinates journalists, you know, it's par for the course there. I think that all these people are going to get wiped out. I just was sitting there with this kind of feeling that there's this coming storm where I really think Bitcoin is the key driver in this, that's going to start to disintermediate a lot of what they've been able to do. And a lot of the ridiculousness of Davos, where it's like a whole bunch of rich people who fly there on private jets lecturing people about yada, yada, yada. I don't think that that's going to be the case in the future. And I think a lot of it has to do with centralized control of money. So I'd say my most provocative belief is that I think in the same way that we believe, or most people believe listening, hopefully, that democracy is better than dictatorship, or that the internet is better than centralized control of information, that ownership of money is, and Bitcoin is going to be seen in the same way, meaning that centralized control of money in like 100 years is going to be looked back at and laughed at. Remember that time when this small group of people controlled all the money? Yeah, that was insane. So that's my provocative thought.
What regulation would you change if you could change one?
In which country?
I'll let you pick.
Okay.
So you can change or improve a regulation anywhere in the world.
Okay. Anywhere in the world. Well, I guess most of your listeners are probably here in the United States. I would change some of the regulations around the telecommunications infrastructure and the way that telecommunications are built that allows the companies that build them to just sort of siphon off our data. So I would, whether it's through like allowing, I'm not an expert in this area, but I want to see more protection of our data And that's a public-private partnership thing. It's not going to be done by the government. It's not going to be done by only companies. It's going to have to be done in a collaborative way where like citizens are also involved, where there's like citizen oversight boards on this stuff. But I don't want to see my texts and emails and things that people think are private, you know, just being like grabbed, through the telecommunications infrastructure.
What's the most important book you've ever read?
The most important book I've ever read. There's quite a few. I will say that just in terms of it being sweeping and moving and educational and thought provoking, and it maybe it's a little trite, but I will have to give the credit to Sapiens. It's just pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. It's like The Brief History of Time, but for humans.
What would be one or two others that are up there with that?
I love this book called The Looming Tower. It's a history of Osama bin Laden and an FBI agent who was tracking him. And it's a dual history of their lives. And it's a lesson about so many different things. But it's a history of the Middle East. It's a history of America. It's a history of police work and intelligence and counterterrorism. And it's just such an amazing book. I would encourage everybody to read it. And, you know, what it really, the lesson, which is so important for this podcast, this conversation, and I think for regulators in general, is that we're going to fight terrorism and the bad guys through old school, hardworking, kind of like investigative police work and collaboration. We're not going to do it through mass surveillance. Mm-hmm. Okay. We don't need mass surveillance. It's not an excuse. So you talk about the failure to catch bin Laden and stop 9/11. It was just such a clusterfuck, basically. I mean, you had different intelligence agencies not speaking to each other. You had people being stopped from being able to do their jobs. There were smart people who were onto this, who could have stopped this, and they were stopped. So I think we need to understand that if we want to catch the bad guys, and there are plenty of bad guys, and I'm a huge supporter of all the people who sacrificed their lives to protect us. But I think we need to let them do their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to let them do their investigative police work. And we don't want is like a sweeping vacuum of all of our data. That's not helpful. That's only gonna lead to tyranny. It's not gonna lead to a safer society. And that's the lesson of The Looming Tower. And that's why you should all read it.
I love it. I ask one non-crypto question and then you can ask me one to finish it up. Mm-hmm. You believe in aliens?
I believe it is inevitable that life either has existed or will exist or does exist somewhere else outside of our little tiny pale blue dot.
A higher probability existed before or will exist after us?
After.
After what? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think there's like if you believe in the creation of the universe, right, that there's been like a finite time between then and now. There could be an infinite time beyond us. So just sort of a basic guess there.
That's fair. What one question do you have for me?
What is your best argument for Bitcoin when you talk to people who are ignorant or kind of scared or uneasy or dismissive? I mean, what do you tell them when you're sitting down with them and you're basically like, look, this is going to change everything. Like, what do you tell them?
So I've shifted very drastically when I go talk to people that mostly institutional investors that have no concept whatsoever of blockchain, crypto, money, you know, all the things that as you kind of go down the rabbit hole, you become much more familiar with and a lot of these narratives and data points. And what I explain to them is the internet, it would be really weird if one country controlled the internet. And they say, yeah, that'd be pretty weird. Right. And I say to them, does it make sense then that the global reserve currency is controlled by one country that is not the largest? Right. And they just happen to control it because they're the most powerful. Mm-hmm. And that usually gets some blank stares, some like, I don't really get it. And I explain, wouldn't it make sense for there to be one currency that everyone agrees on, that everyone has transparency into, that no one could manipulate? And also could be used on the internet in a global scalable way that was more efficient and cheaper to use than what we have today. And I would say
30-40%, they get there and like, oh yeah, that does sound pretty interesting, right? The idea that, hey, today we've got the internet and I can send it from my phone and I don't have to worry about, you know, hours of operations and all this kind of stuff. There's a probably about 30-40% that say, I understand what you're saying. I don't believe it'll happen, right? So you kind of get, let's call it 60-80% of people, they get the idea. And there's 20% who just say, I don't get it, right? And the people that I get most excited about are the people who actually get it and don't think it's going to happen. Because as I go back and talk with them a month, 3 months, 6 months, you know, 12 months later, the probability in their mind that it's not going to happen has reduced. So they started out at 99% likelihood it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now they're at like 96, right? Now they're at 90. Now they're at 85. And what you can see is that they are, it's becoming demystified to them. Right. Yes. They're starting to understand it a little bit better. They're starting to now pay attention when Wells Fargo goes down.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I can't actually use my card. Right.
The system is broken.
Yeah. They weren't paying attention. Right. I call it like everyone's asleep at the wheel, both the incumbents and also kind of the population. But once you've been made aware of a different type of system, you may not believe that the new system is better, but you do become more aware of why your system is broken. And I think that's the, like, getting them to see that over and over and over again just takes time. And eventually they convert over and they say, yeah, you're right.
And as a concluding thought, I would tell everyone listening, it's a really smart idea for you to invest your time in Bitcoin. Even if Bitcoin project, even if it fails, which I find highly unlikely, the time you spend learning about how it works, why we need decentralized money, why we need private money, why we need cash in a cashless society, how do monetary systems work, what is the relationship between monetary systems and government, how does government create money, how do people network together, how do peer-to-peer networks function, what is cryptography, what is public-private key cryptography, how do these things manifest into liberation tools? What is it like for people who don't have access to a working financial system? What is their day like? You know, how does their savings get taken away from them? When you learn about Bitcoin, you learn about all of these things. And it's such a valuable investment of your time. And hopefully it lights a little fire in you to start learning more and more and more, like it did with me. And it shows you how relevant, and it kind of is like this great reveal. It's like taking the red pill in the Matrix. I can no longer kind of look at the world in the same way. And if there's one thing I could gift to someone else, it's this gift of starting to unravel the world through the lens of Bitcoin, and how curious it makes you, how staggering it is, and you know how much it teaches you about what you didn't know. So I think that would be the concluding thought. Invest your time in Bitcoin.
I love it, man. I really appreciate you coming on. This is awesome. I think people are really going to enjoy it, so I'll do it again.
I hope so. Thanks so much.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.